And welcome to episode 2. They didn't kick us out.
There must be some oversight somewhere.
Or we're still flying under the radar, one or the other, you know?
Or we just have no listeners. Either way, works for me.
Yeah, we listen to each other.
Yeah, okay, so there's three, because John doesn't have a choice.
He is Soren Fanning. I am Anthony Moretti. This is episode 2 of Upon Further Review with...
The Podcast Profs.
Indeed. And John Roland is, of course, keeping us both on time and like, organized and that kind of stuff.
I try not to look at the cattle prod he's got hidden under his desk.
I know. Well, he whacked me in the knees a couple of times. No, he didn't. I am kidding. Let's begin this week with, politics in Washington are politics in Washington.
Indeed.
But sometimes the real world gets in the way and, Congress does the right thing.
Right. And sometimes they get pushed into doing the right thing even when they don't want to. So, there's been a couple of, I'd say, events intruding, but I'm sure the good people of Houston would feel differently. We had Hurricane Harvey that dumped 50 inches of rain. I want you to pause. That's not snow. That's water.
Mm-hmm.
That's practically my daughter's height in total precipitation. It was just unreal. If you saw the pictures of
Are you telling
Houston,
us that Emily's all wet?
We
better just keep moving
right
along. I have
my Fifth Amendment
privilege,
right?
Yeah, we better move right along.
But if you saw the pictures, I mean, it looked like Venice. But it just completely drowned. So, and remember, Houston's the fourth largest city in the U.S. So we have that. Congress needed to appropriate funds.
And did, to the tune of almost $8 billion, which, while a lot, is nowhere near what it's going to take to put the people of Houston, back into the homes that are even closely resembling what they had.
This is the down payment, basically. Yeah.
$150 billion is the preliminary estimate from the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott. And let's face it, it's going to go up. $150 billion is a preliminary estimate based on, these number of people, these number of houses, that sort of thing.
And it's funny. It reminds me of the old phrase by Lyndon Johnson, a billion here, a billion there. Sooner or later, you start talking about real money.
So do you think, the Congress has allocated $8 billion. In reality, they basically need to put an extra zero on that and then double it, essentially. Are they going to?
The alternative is basically allowing the fourth largest city in the United States to drown. People may not like it, but they may not like it, but we have to do this. Houston is, last I checked, part of the United States.
Yes. And the reason I ask, are they going to do it, is because, let's face it, we know that there is a sizable percentage of the people in Congress, most specifically from the Tea Party, that will tell you that, government needs to slash funds, government needs to slash funds, government needs to slash funds. The irony is many of those people, well, not many, but a couple of them are from that part of the country and from that state.
Disproportionate number are from that. I'm looking at you, Ted Cruz, Mr. I voted against Superstorm Sandy funding. Now the shoe's
on the
other
foot. That wouldn't
have
had to do anything with the fact that Barack Obama was president, did it?
Oh, far be it for me to suggest such a thing. Totally did.
And Chris Christie was likely to be a presidential candidate from the same party?
Indeed.
That you don't think those had anything to do with it?
Well, what's interesting is we have this myth that the Republican Party controls all branches of government. On paper, they do. But the reality is we don't have two political parties in the country. We have at least three. The Republican Party is barely a cohesive party at all. It more accurately represents conjoined twins. You have the old Republican Party, which has always been there. This is the party of Reagan and Bush and all that. Then you have the Freedom Caucus Tea Party over here, which best exemplified by probably Rand Paul of Kentucky. And the two almost never get along. One of the reasons this Congress hasn't gotten anything done is they've completely ruled out cooperation with the Democrats, but they can't even get cooperation among themselves. So in reality, the Republican Party, you have a member of the Republican Party, ostensibly, and we'll get to that in a minute, in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
They have the largest number of seats in the Congress on paper. In reality, They probably don't. They're probably actually in a minority position between the Democrats and the Tea Party.
Well, you know, and the other uh-oh that you can't ignore is, all right, let's say $150 billion does become the actual figure for Texas. Let's just, for sake of argument, let's say it does. How much is Florida going to need in about a week and a half?
Considering,
well, less.
Well, yeah, by this weekend. And but according to all the projections, and forgive the analogy, but it's about to get mounted by Irma like a brandy dog. And that hurricane is just going to drive straight up the panhandle.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, strongest storm ever recorded to have formed in the Atlantic.
But climate change and global warming is a hoax, you know, being perpetrated by the Chinese. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, well, you know, Rush Limbaugh notwithstanding.
Rush Limbaugh. May I?
Oh, by all means.
May I? Rush Limbaugh is entitled to hold whatever political opinions he wants. Provided,
it is a free country.
It is a free country. Provided that any political opinion you have is grounded in at least some factual reality, I am good with it. As I said here last week, I disagreed with the idea of moving the United States out of the climate change accords. But you know what? That's a political decision that a president's going to make. It's a policy-driven decision. I think it's a foolish one, but you know what?
Right.
That's fine. For Rush Limbaugh to argue on the radio, as he did a couple of days ago, that in essence, the media were trying to make a bigger deal of Harvey and make a bigger deal of Irma so that batteries and toilet paper and bread could be bought, and that they could therefore also to some extent generate
I'm sorry, I can't even keep a straight face.
Forget for a moment that that's a ludicrous idea on paper.
I had no idea the Energizer company had that kind of sway.
That kind of power,
yeah,
you know? I mean, forget the ridiculous idea on paper.
Right.
It's the irresponsibility to suggest to millions of people that are his listeners, independent of where they live in the country. I don't care if they live in Washington State or Florida. Irrelevant. To tell these people that in essence, the media's job of preparing people for a hurricane is essentially fake news or a hoax is irresponsibility at perhaps its worst. And for someone who has been in the radio industry as long as he has, to pass this nonsense off as a legitimate thought is irresponsible is the nicest word I can come up with.
You're
without,
being very generous.
I know down the hall, you know, Michael DeLauro, who is the guru of all things the Academic Media Center, and more specifically the director of the Academic Media Center. I don't want him calling me into his office afterwards and saying you can't use those words. But you know, I'm thinking them. I mean, how could Rush Limbaugh be that irresponsible? But let's get back to the serious conversation. Go ahead.
Okay, well, so we have these three groups, and you know, these storms are forcing people to confront reality as opposed to ideology. Ideology is great in theory, but at the end of the day, we have to deal with the real world. And the stone cold fact of the matter is, Hurricane Irma is a Category 5 hurricane. There is no Category 6.
Mm-hmm.
It's open ended. Anything with winds, I believe it's over 160 miles per hour sustained. And to give you an idea of how big Irma is, the eye of this hurricane is 25 nautical miles in diameter. That's mm-hmm. the size of Allegheny County.
Mm-hmm. If you took it from its northern tip to its southern tip, it would go from Jacksonville to Miami.
Yeah.
It's essentially covering the entire state of Florida.
Indeed. And this is going to wreak untold havoc. And if that wasn't bad enough, if you needed proof that we don't have two, but rather more than two political parties, the collective freakout last night
mm-hmm.
by the Republican Party when President Trump cut a deal with Democrats to keep the lights on in the government was something to behold. And this is where I have to just, this is my facepalm moment.
Okay.
This is the first time since the election that I have seen Republican leaders 100% genuinely incensed.
At the president. Exactly.
It wasn't after Chancellorsville. Sorry, Civil War. Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't after the pardon of Joe Arpaio. And it wasn't after the repeal of DACA, which we're going to get to in a second.
Mm-hmm.
It was that he dared to work with Democrats. This mm-hmm. is emblematic of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Where working with people with whom you have disagreements, but you agree on this one issue, is anathema. And look, I'll lead the charge. I have to admit that right now, and I, I feel dirty saying it, but I agree with President Trump on something.
Mm-hmm.
He made the argument that the debt ceiling should be abolished, and I 100% agree.
I agree with him as well on that issue. Look, here is, and the reason I asked the $150 billion in Texas again, let's assume that that number is the accurate number, just for sake of discussion. Sure. Let's assume we have $150 billion worth of damage in Florida as well. Just again, for sake of argument.
We'll be lucky if it's only that, but
let's
just
say, so two of America's five biggest states are going to need in the neighborhood of $300 billion to put their people right again.
I would argue that the final tally is probably going to be in the vicinity of $500 billion.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But again, just for sake of argument, let's just make it $300 billion.
Sure.
Can you say tax hike? Where else are you going to come up with
the
money?
Well, logically, yes. And here's the thing. If you have a country of 325 million people, you don't need to raise tax revenues that much to make that shortfall up.
But you have to. But let's face it, you are going to see some, and you know, and I'm not picking on the Republicans here, but you know as well as I, some Republican is going to say, he or she's going to want a one-for-one match. So for every dollar you're going to raise to give to Florida or Texas in, right, quote, tax hikes, unquote, has to be met with a corresponding dollar of cuts in spending somewhere. So in other words, a revenue-neutral decision.
Right.
Are you going to cut $300 billion unless you cut the Defense Department? And
right,
that's not going to happen.
And you know, speaking of breaking an omerta, that's it.
That's not going to happen.
This is the way I explain it in my classes. If you want to know the problems of political leadership, here it is. And it's very simple. You have three things. You have a strong military.
Mm-hmm.
You have people whose basic needs are met.
Mm-hmm.
And you have low taxes. You can pick any two of those three.
Yep.
But you cannot have all three at once.
You can't.
So you can pick any two. And the problem is right now, for years, the people with basic needs men was the one that was forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
I think the election of Donald Trump and that sort of cry of collective rage,
mm-hmm,
is taking that off the table. That's actually something that in theory, this Republican president and the Democratic Party can break bread on.
But not much.
Not much. Well, a crust.
Because, and just as a reminder, you are listening to the episode 2 of Upon Further Review with
the Podcast Profs.
He is Soren Fanning. I am Anthony Moretti. John Roland is keeping us on time and on track. If the Democrats and the president suddenly had a, wow, maybe we do like each other for a second.
Well, let's not overstate.
Let's not overstate that, right? But if they had,
I think it's more of a, wow, we can afford to, we can stand to sit at the same table for 30 seconds.
And not like hate each other.
Right.
If that was the case, then explain to me what happened a couple of days before we began to talk about the debt ceiling, when the president used his attorney general, by the way.
Yeah, I love how he didn't want to go in front of the cameras.
He didn't.
Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III.
No. Do it in that southern voice.
The foghorn leghorn?
Yes.
Mr. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III.
Thank you very
Esquire.
Much. Esquire. Or attorney general, as the case might be. Is DACA really dead?
No.
I agree with you.
No.
And why
no.
is DACA not really dead?
Well, first of all, when you and I were planning out the fall semester's worth of these shows, this was going to be the announcement because September is Hispanic Heritage Month.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which is worse, the idea that the president had no idea it was Hispanic Heritage Month when he announced this, or the fact that he knew and did it anyway. For those of you who are not familiar, DACA, D-A-C-A, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals,
mm-hmm,
law, essentially said if you were brought illegally to the United States when you were a minor, you had no choice in the matter, it was through no decision of yours, that essentially if you have a clean legal record, you have no criminal record, you're gainfully employed, register with the government and we will make an exception in your case and you can stay.
Mm-hmm. Holds true if you're in college as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And during the campaign, Donald Trump, is stoking these nativist sentiments, vowed to get rid of it. And apparently out of the blue, decided, okay, well, last Friday was going to be the day, right before the Labor Day weekend.
No, right before Harvey blasted Texas.
Right, Andrew, and of course now Irma's hitting Florida. So there is that. But here's where the devil is in the details. He said if Congress doesn't replace the law in 6 months...
with a real immigration policy.
Whatever the heck that means. In 6 months, that they're going to have to start deportations. 6 months from the beginning of September is mid-February. This is as the midterm election season starts getting cranked up.
And how many months does Congress take off around the... or how many weeks does Congress take off around the holidays?
Something like six.
So that means 4.5 months.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, this is the equivalent of taking a hand grenade, pulling out the pin, and just tossing it to Paul Ryan.
And
saying,
keep in mind,
here, have this.
Going back to what you discussed a couple of minutes ago, and have mentioned on other podcasts as well, you're not dealing with a Congress that's basically saying to each other, yeah, okay, let's do something right here. You're essentially dealing with the Democrats who very easily could take a step back and say, this is your problem. Come up with something that, you know, we will endorse, or come up with something that is going to be draconian and let us use it against you in the 2018 midterm elections.
Right. And in theory, if we were in a rational world, this would actually be a great gift to the Republican Party.
Yes, it would.
Because they could basically just pull the DREAM Act out, dust it off, submit it again. They would get clearly enough Democrats to sign on to that. It would pass overwhelmingly. Trump would sign it. And what they would do is they would basically correct this image, rightly or wrongly, that the Republican Party is anti-Latino American. But of course, that's not going to happen. And this is the reason our politics are so dysfunctional is really rooted in three things. And they all work together. Thing number one.
It sounds like a child.
What's that?
Thing one, thing two sounds things like a child.
It's civics with Dr. Seuss. So,
oh, Lord.
Yeah. So thing number one that you have to contend with is the fact that rural communities in the United States are heavily overrepresented. Wyoming, which has fewer people, by the way, than the Pittsburgh metro area, has the same number of senators as California. So that's one. Number two, gerrymandering after the 2010 midterms gave the Republican Party an ironclad lock on the House of Representatives. Now, the Republicans are not the first party to try gerrymandering. This is just the most recent instance. Those two things aren't enough. Here's the third factor. The number one fear every elected Republican in the House has is losing a primary challenge to someone further than to the right than they are, which means effectively you have that Tea Party, this 20% of the country, one-fifth, dictating the agenda for the other four-fifths. Again, if this were a completely objective system, this would be something where something like 80% of the country favors DACA.
But when I asked you at the beginning of this thread of the conversation, if you thought that, in essence, DACA was going to be doomed completely, you and I both said no.
Yeah.
So why do you think something is going to happen positively to fix it?
I think what's going to happen is the Republican Party is going to have to draw lots. You know, who's safest for re-election? They will then partner with the Democrats just enough to pass it through the House. In the Senate, the Republican Senate majority is a lot more secure. They don't want to see this thing die either. Again, they'll pass it. Basically, you'll get the usual suspects: Susan Collins, John McCain, Lisa Murkowski.
See, I see it differently. I think this is eventually going to go up to and through on a rush to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is going to declare it constitutional, meaning that you can't throw these people out. See, I don't think Congress is going to get its act together. I think it's going to go through the courts to get it done.
It might, but I think what's getting lost in all this isn't, I mean, people have done what's the economic impact going to be. Forget that for a second. Let's talk about the social impact. Let's say you have lived here your entire conscious life. Maybe you were brought here when you were two. you don't speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know why you don't speak Spanish? Because you grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
This is the only home you've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're something like, you know, let's say you're getting ready to graduate from college. And you're facing the very real prospect that maybe, possibly, perhaps, in 6 months, you will be booted out of the United States to God knows where with no citizenship, no language, and knowing no one. Now multiply that by 800,000. That is that just the stress levels alone are catastrophic. And even if Congress doesn't get its act together, I have to think that if nothing else, you're going to have churches and cities, and I'm not saying blue cities. I mean conservative cities, liberal cities, cities in between, are essentially going to act in civil disobedience and just not obey this law.
Speaking of civil disobedience or irresponsible speech, whichever you wish to suggest, did you see Steve Bannon's comment about the Catholic Church's support of DACA?
Nothing surprises me about Steve Bannon.
An excerpt of the interview that Steve Bannon has given with 60 Minutes that will air on Sunday night. He is quoted as saying that the reason the Catholic Church is in support of DACA is because it needs those illegal aliens to fill the pews every weekend.
That is ridiculous.
So let me see if I get
this
right.
Not only am I not Catholic, I'm a Buddhist. So, I mean, even I know that's ridiculous.
So let me see if I get this right. I am going to, in the span of two sentences or maybe one, I am going to offend however many million Catholics there are in this country. I don't know. But let's just for sake of argument say there are 50 million. I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Right.
But just for sake of argument, let's say there is. And I am also then going to go ahead and basically take a backhanded swipe at anyone who is of any sort of Latino ancestry and suggest that one of the reasons they go to church is because they will find not only their need for or belief in God fulfilled, but they will also find, to some extent, a sanctuary, literally and figuratively.
It's almost like being a sanctuary from persecution is what the church was founded on.
No.
Don't
inject history into this conversation.
I will say this. The writer J. Michael Straczynski had a great line that applies perfectly to Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon might be the most efficient ideologue in the U.S. because he can combine arrogance and stupidity all in the same package.
I thought that was Rush Limbaugh.
Again, we have to watch our language because the director. This is a funded project.
It is a glassed in or a glassed window operation with the director right down the hall, right?
There's only one exit.
We have to play nice, you know, so. on the radio. This is again episode two of the infamous. Nah, we're not infamous yet.
We're approaching it.
Upon further review with
the podcast profs.
Indeed. He's Soren Fanning. I'm Anthony Moretti. John Roland is keeping us in tune.
And in the final few minutes, there is a topic near and dear to your heart. Speaking of Florida disasters.
Can I clear my throat just to get revved up on this one?
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, if you could see Dr. Moretti right now, he has a grin that could only be described as impish, possibly crossbred with evil. But he's looking forward to this. So there is a story out of Florida State University you wish to discuss.
Discuss or go on a tirade?
So hold on. Let me get the soapbox. All right. There you go.
There we go. All right. I'm going to take this. I'm going to start quietly or try to.
Remember, it has to be PG-13.
Oh, shucks. Florida State University is one of the great football powers in this country. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing at all wrong with being a football power. Nothing at all as well with ensuring that the athletes that are on the football team or the basketball team or the softball team or the you name it team are also making satisfactory progress toward a degree. They may not finish it in 4 years. That's okay.
Right.
But if they're making satisfactory progress and they are earning the grades and the courses that they take, more power to these young men and women because they have a really difficult, you know, life.
Student athletes.
Yes.
Yes.
Look, I understand that, you know, students work. I understand that, you know, the students that we have here are not financially well off top to bottom that they can basically say, I can go to class, I can go home, and life is good.
Right.
No, a lot of them have to work. I get that. But I understand that for student athletes, the workload is to some extent even higher because there is that chronic travel associated with it.
Correct.
There is that chronic odd hours of games and that sort of
practices,
thing. Practices and whatever. Yeah. Okay. Let me now that I've sort of gotten the background out of the way. A few years ago, a teaching assistant at Florida State University became aware that several athletes, all on the football team, as I understand the story, were, in essence, allowed to do darn near anything unethical that we wouldn't accept from normal students in order for them to stay academically eligible.
Violations of academic integrity.
Everything stemming sort of from plagiarism to somebody else writing a paper to presenting work that was clearly deficient and still being given a passing grade. So all of these were, not all of these. Some of these issues were detailed in a New York Times report that is going to be part of a book that is being released relatively soon. The teaching assistant who came forward with these issues,
who did the right thing,
was dismissed from the program. Well, not dismissed from the program. She lost her teaching assistantship, which meant she couldn't afford to complete school anymore. She was 1 year from finishing her doctoral program.
Oh my heavens!
All right, 1 year. So. The New York Times story came out on Friday of last week, a day before Florida State played Alabama in one of the most likely biggest college football games of the year. Today, last night technically, the Florida State president wrote a open letter to the Alumni Association, essentially saying, you know, how dare the New York Times do this? Mind you, he never said the New York Times got their facts wrong. We're going to sue. What he essentially said is, we recognize our mistakes from the past and we have moved on.
How dare you point them out?
So let me see if I get this right. You are tacitly acknowledging that the national championship your school won 3 years ago was won largely on the basis of some of the most important players being allowed to be losers or cheaters in the classroom, and you tolerated this?
Yes.
And the man who is still the football coach was the football coach then, and you are tolerating this? And you are not saying to the football coach, how dare you? You are not saying to the professors involved, how dare you? Maybe you're doing so privately, but if you're going to take the New York Times to task publicly, why don't you also take to task publicly the people who allowed this gross behavior to take place? All in the name of keeping some of your most talented players eligible so that they could win a few more football games. What message does that send?
It means the message it sends is the ends justify the means. Just, you know, win at any cost, which is probably not the message we actually want people to learn.
It's again, we talk about people saying irresponsible things. If there's been a thread to this podcast, I think one of the threads has been that words have responsibility, actions and words mean something, etc.
And that responsibility goes up given your status in any institution.
I am perfectly okay with him saying publicly, how dare the New York Times rehash these details. If he says, you know what?
We screwed up. Yeah.
We would prefer this not be dredged up every now and then, but you know what? We made this mistake. We'd prefer to have people acknowledge that we've moved on, but in the past, we made mistakes. But you know what? You should also document how you've moved on. What policies have been put in place? Would you dare consider suspending this head football coach for a game or more?
Or at the very least, just publicly admit to having erred.
A double standard.
Yeah.
That can't happen. At least isn't happening, at least not yet, in this case.
Well, you know, maybe this will be what we call the Joel Osteen effect, where enough public shame might actually push people.
No. That megachurch was flooded. He couldn't open the doors.
Invisibly flooded, too.
Flooded.
Yeah. You know, for those of you listening, I hope you heard the air quotes there.
Mm-hmm. So. We have to wrap up, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
Darn.
But we will be back next week.
We will.
And we would absolutely love to hear from you listeners. What would you like us to discuss? Do you have any questions? Do you have any issues that you would like us to tackle? We would be happy to do so. Aside from that, that will be it for episode 2 of Upon Further Review.
With the podcast profs.
I am Soren Fanning. He is Anthony Moretti. And we will see you next week.